Welcome to The Debate. Today, we're digging into opposing views for the federal news update for Friday, September 5th, 2025. I'm Regan Bush.
And I'm Carter Clinton. It's good to be here.
Absolutely. So the first week of September 2025, well, it's been incredibly active. A whole series of executive actions coming out of the administration. These directives, they're touching on pretty much everything: reorganizing federal agencies, immigration policy shifts, national security posture, even domestic innovation.
Right. A very assertive agenda. And often happening without much legislative back and forth, it seems.
Exactly. Which, predictably, has led to some significant pushback from the federal courts. And that brings us to our central question today. Are these recent court rulings from early September, are they appropriately asserting the judiciary's role as, you know, a necessary check on executive power? Or are they perhaps an overreach that's actually getting in the way of the administration's legitimate policy goals?
That's the core tension.
So I'll be arguing that the courts are performing a vital constitutional function here, acting as that essential check.
And I'll be taking the view that, well, these judicial interventions might actually be going too far, hindering necessary policy implementation.
And all of this discussion really springs directly from the details in the Federal News Update, September 5th, 2025. Okay, so let's get into it. You know, what really strikes me about these rulings is how powerfully the judiciary seems to have stepped up. It feels like they're reaffirming their role, almost drawing a clear line in the sand. My position is, well, it's firmly rooted in these specific decisions we've seen. They uphold established legal principles, and importantly, they safeguard the separation of powers. Take the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals decision on the Alien Enemies Act. That's a law from 1798, a wartime measure. The court very clearly rejected the administration's, let's say, expansive argument to use this old act for summary deportation of alleged gang members.
Mm-hmm.
The court ruled that the phrase invasion or predatory incursion in that act refers to actual military activities directed by a foreign nation. It doesn't mean criminal acts or illegal immigration. And by doing that, it reinforces crucial due process rights. Now, this isn't just some minor legal point. It's a fundamental defense against the executive sort of unilaterally expanding its wartime powers into domestic criminal issues, which would effectively bypass modern immigration due process.
Okay.
Similarly, you have a federal judge's ruling against deploying military troops domestically in Los Angeles that forcefully upheld the Posse Comitatus Act, the 1878 law limiting military use for domestic law enforcement. It ensures our armed forces aren't used for policing within our borders. That's a critical check, especially against any attempt, as the judge noted, to create a national police force with the president as its chief. And then, in a really significant move, the D.C. Circuit 7-4 ruling on presidential tariff authority under EPA. That's the International Emergency Economic Powers Act.
Right, the Emergency Powers Act.
Exactly. It clarified that while IEEPA gives the president broad authority in emergencies, it does not grant the power to impose tariffs or taxes unilaterally. This decision basically reasserts Congress's constitutional power over trade policy. So these aren't just, you know, legal niceties. They are vital constitutional guardrails. They ensure the administration operates within its legal and constitutional limits.
Okay. Well, I come at it from a different way. My perspective diverges pretty significantly here. While, of course, the judiciary has a vital role, I'd argue that these recent rulings aren't simply a proper assertion of checks and balances. Instead, I think they reflect an overreaching interpretation that is actively obstructing the administration's, frankly, critical and decisive policy initiatives. These aren't abstract legal debates playing out in a vacuum. They are direct impediments to addressing really pressing national security, economic, and social challenges.
Okay.
Take that 5th Circuit Alien Enemies Act ruling you mentioned. From my perspective, it unduly hampers the administration's ability to respond to modern threats, these sort of hybrid threats we face now.
when you have transnational criminal organizations like Tren de Aragua, this Venezuelan gang that's expanding aggressively, engaged in what the administration sees as predatory incursions. Well, the executive needs the flexibility to act decisively for national security. Expecting an 18th century law to be interpreted so strictly against this modern context, it feels like it ties the executive's hands.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's the D.C. Circuit's tariff ruling. The administration has already appealed it to the Supreme Court, which tells you how seriously they view it. This decision really curtails the president's ability to navigate complex global trade dynamics and, importantly, protect vital domestic economic interests. It directly undermines the America First agenda, and this is happening just as the August jobs report shows a significant economic slowdown.
Right. The timing is certainly notable.
Exactly. And finally, that U.S. district judge's ruling on Harvard University funding. Look, this interferes with what the administration sees as legitimate efforts to ensure federal funds align with its policy priorities, particularly around issues like DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and the broader goal of, quote, deconstruction of the administrative state, which is an agenda aimed at reducing the power of federal agencies. These judicial actions, taken together, they risk creating policy paralysis. They stifle necessary executive agility, I believe.
Okay, Carter, I hear your argument for executive flexibility, especially with that 1798 Act. But let me push back a bit. If we allow an 18th century wartime act, like the Alien Enemies Act, to be stretched to cover domestic criminal issues, aren't we essentially chipping away at decades of established due process? And doesn't that set a potentially dangerous precedent for future administrations, regardless of their political leaning? The court's interpretation, I'd say, isn't a hindrance. It's a necessary clarification. It prevents the executive from just unilaterally expanding wartime powers into the domestic sphere. The principle here is crucial. Serious criminal activity, however grave, is just not legally the same as an act of war directed by a foreign nation. To allow that conflation bypasses modern immigration due process, meaning people could be deported without hearings, without lawyers, without appeals that are normally guaranteed. And similarly, that ruling on the Posse Comitatus Act in Los Angeles, it isn't about hamstringing the executive. It's about safeguarding a really fundamental, long-standing principle separating our military from domestic policing. That's a critical check against any move towards, as the judge put it, creating a national police force with the president as its chief. These rulings ensure that even when things feel like a crisis, constitutional norms and legal frameworks have to be observed. The insight here, I think, is that upholding these legal distinctions, even when the executive perceives an urgent threat, ultimately strengthens our system. It prevents overreach and maintains that delicate balance of power.
I understand the reasoning. I do. But my concern lingers. Is the judiciary truly equipped to assess the rapidly evolving nature of these modern threats and, frankly, economic shifts? Does their interpretation adequately balance those foundational principles you mentioned with the urgent realities the executive branch believes it's facing? The administration, as I said, views these transnational criminal groups not just as criminals, but as narco-terrorists.
So the administration is explicitly framing it that way?
Yes, that's the framing. They see it as posing a direct, almost existential threat to national security, which in their view justifies a more aggressive, perhaps even military-style response. The courts, from this perspective, seem to be applying an anachronistic interpretation to a security landscape that's changing incredibly fast. The Fifth Circuit's decision arguably ties the executive's hands when confronting what it sees as an urgent threat on U.S. soil, potentially slowing down critical responses.
Okay.
And regarding the domestic deployment issue, the administration believes it must have the ability to respond robustly to significant internal disruptions. The judge's order condemning the president's supposed goal of creating a national police force, well, it feels like it's projecting an intention rather than focusing purely on the immediate operational necessity as defined by the executive. The practical insight here, I think, is that an overly rigid judicial interpretation, especially in these fast-moving areas like trade and national security, can inadvertently cripple an administration's agility. It forces it into a reactive mode rather than a proactive one against global challenges. These are decisive actions the administration thinks are essential, and judicial interference just introduces uncertainty and delays.
That's a strong argument for executive flexibility, particularly in national security. But let's pivot slightly from security to economic policy. Carter, you also brought up the administration's tariff strategy. How exactly do you see that D.C. Circuit ruling on the IEPAA impacting things?
Well, that D.C. Circuit ruling on presidential tariff authority under IEEPA, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, it's a direct blow, a really direct blow to the administration's economic policy, and at a precarious time. The August jobs report, as I mentioned, showed only 22,000 jobs added. Manufacturing actually lost 12,000 positions. And you have UNCTAD, the UN trade body itself, stating that trade policy uncertainty, driven largely by U.S. actions, has, quote, soared to record levels and is a major source of global instability. So this ruling fundamentally undermines the president's ability to use tariffs as a strategic tool to protect domestic industries, try to level the playing field, address what are seen as unfair trade practices. It could potentially invalidate billions of dollars in existing tariffs and cause significant market disruption, especially now that it's being appealed to the Supreme Court. The president feels he needs this economic leverage to address what he perceives as an unfolding economic crisis, partly fueled by global trade imbalances. The practical insight here is that while courts focus on legal precedent, maybe an overly rigid judicial view of emergency powers can cripple that agility needed to respond to immediate economic threats with speed.
Carter, I absolutely can see the administration is under immense pressure. There are real pressing economic issues. However, the severity of those challenges, no matter how pressing they feel, it simply doesn't grant the executive unlimited power to bypass Congress's explicit constitutional authority over taxation and trade. That D.C. Circuit ruling, remember, was a decisive 7-4 decision. It clarifies that while IEPA grants significant authority in emergencies, it does not explicitly include the power to just impose tariffs or taxes. So this isn't really about hindering economic policy per se. It's about upholding the fundamental separation of powers. Congress, not the president, holds the purse strings and the power to regulate commerce. That's foundational.
Mm-hmm.
The courts are essentially ensuring that how a statute is interpreted aligns with what Congress actually intended. And in this case, that means safeguarding Congress's role in a major area of economic policy. You know, this isn't just about tariffs. It highlights a recurring constitutional tension, doesn't it? Where executive efficiency, especially during crises, often clashes with Congress's fundamental control over money and trade. That tension has shaped American governance for centuries, and it's constantly being redefined. And I think the administration's broader pattern of aggressive use of executive orders, like EO 143043 on labor relations, directives aiming to close the Department of Education, it underscores a pattern that the judiciary is almost compelled to examine as a systematic challenge to that separation of powers.
That's a compelling point about the constitutional structure, Reagan. And yet, I might suggest that if Congress is perceived as unable or perhaps unwilling to act quickly enough to address these urgent economic threats, then the executive must have tools readily available. My concern is whether the courts, in focusing so intently on that separation, are taking too narrow a view of the tools the executive needs to protect national economic interests, when legislative action often feels too slow for global shifts.
And speaking of the administration's broader agenda and these judicial checks, let's touch on that federal funding issue you both raised earlier, specifically the Harvard University case. That seems like another real flashpoint.
Yes, and my analysis leads me to a different conclusion regarding the Harvard funding situation. Look, the administration's actions there, and more generally its directives concerning DEI programs within the Department of Education, these stem from a stated policy goal: to realign federal influence away from what it deems progressive social policies. Now, while academic freedom is certainly important, the administration argues it has a legitimate interest, maybe even a duty, to ensure that federal funds, taxpayer dollars, are allocated in ways that align with its stated national interests and educational priorities. So the judge's ruling, viewed through that lens, can be seen as an impediment to the administration's broader agenda to reshape the federal apparatus
and redirect resources according to its mandate. If the administration perceives certain university programs or governance structures as undermining national interests or core values, it believes it should have the latitude to review and adjust funding. This court decision limits the executive's capacity to drive significant policy changes using fiscal mandates.
You've definitely highlighted the administration's policy goals there, Carter. But the Harvard funding case, I think, is particularly revealing about the limits of that executive power. U.S. District Judge Allison Burroughs was incredibly explicit. She found the administration's termination of, what, $2.6 billion in federal research grants was unlawful. She called it illegal retaliation. And she directly stated that the administration's stated reasons, the allegations of anti-Semitism, were, in her words, a smokescreen for a targeted, ideologically motivated assault on this country's premier universities.
Strong language from the judge.
Very strong. And this ruling is vital, I think, because it protects academic freedom and the First Amendment. It prevents the executive branch from using the immense power of the federal purse, essentially, to coerce ideological conformity or demand sweeping governance changes at private institutions. It reinforces a key principle. Federal funding can come with conditions, yes, but not conditions that undermine constitutional rights or due process, which is what the judge found happened here. The deeper insight, perhaps, is how the judiciary can serve as a bulwark against attempts to weaponize federal funding for political or ideological ends, thereby protecting the autonomy and integrity of these institutions. So, to summarize my view, these various federal court rulings in early September 2025, the Fifth Circuit on the Alien Enemies Act, the D.C. Circuit on tariffs, the District Court on Harvard's funding, taken together, they demonstrate a crucial and, I'd argue, effective assertion of judicial review. These decisions uphold fundamental principles, separation of powers, reinforcing civil liberties through due process, ensuring executive actions stay within constitutional and statutory lines. This judicial engagement acts as a necessary, robust check on an administration that has consistently sought to expand its authority and implement its agenda largely through directives and regulatory changes, often bypassing traditional legislative routes. It's a powerful reminder, I think, that even in times of perceived crisis or urgent policy needs, the rule of law must prevail.
Well, my analysis leads me to quite a different conclusion. While the judiciary undoubtedly has a role to play, the cumulative effect of these specific rulings is to significantly impede a determined administration's efforts to implement its agenda across critical areas, national security, economic policy, the direction of federal influence in education. These judicial interventions, whether they concern counter-narcotic strategies, trade tariffs, or university funding, they represent a substantial interference with executive discretion, and arguably, they could exacerbate the very national challenges the administration is trying to address. The administration views its actions as necessary, as legitimate responses to pressing issues. The courts, by taking what feels like a narrow and sometimes maybe an anachronistic view, stifle the flexibility and decisiveness that modern governance often seems to demand. This tension really highlights the potential cost, the very real cost, of an overly cautious judiciary when executive action is perceived by the executive as essential for national well-being.
Indeed. The interplay between the executive and judiciary, it remains this dynamic tension. And with significant appeals potentially heading to the Supreme Court, it's clear this debate is far from over.
Absolutely.
We hope this discussion today has illuminated some of the complex perspectives surrounding the role of judicial review in shaping policy and governance right now. There is clearly much more to explore in the federal news update for Friday, September 5th, 2025.